He's joining us from Trondheim in Norway. And before I present her in more detail, I would just like to say a few words on this, on the gender lectures in general, and on our center, Interdisciplinary Gender Studies at the University of Innsbruck. So, as you might know, the Innsbruck Gender Lectures are a discussion and exchange forum that has been founded to allow members of the Center Interdisciplinary Gender Studies at the University of Innsbruck and researchers on gender issues from Austria and abroad to take a look at charged issues, to discuss them from a gender critical perspective and to exchange views on theoretical principles and current topics. So the gender lectures are supposed to make a major contribution to our internationalization to the internationalization of gender studies at our university. And we are very happy, Lieber, that you agreed to speak to us today. As you also might know, the gender lectures are recorded, and even if you have to leave today for one reason or another, or if you would like to re-listen to the gender lectures, you can do this via Freirad, Radio Freirad, yeah, because the gender lectures are normally archived, and so you can, even if you want to listen to it again in a few months or in a year, this would be possible for you. My name is Doris Eibel, by the way. I should have presented myself, but I'm a little nervous. I normally do I don't do moderations in English normally, rather in French or German. So my name is Doris Eibel, and I teach French and Francophone literature at the Romance Languages and Literatures Department. So now you understand why I'm a little nervous doing this moderation in English. And I would like to introduce Liebe very shortly. Liebe has already spent some time in Innsbruck in 2013, teaching at the English department, English Studies department. And when she left us, she first went to the UK, and living in Cambridge for a while. And she's now Associate Professor of Literature in English in the Department of Teacher Education at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim. She is also a research affiliate for the Canadian Literature Center at the University of Alberta in Canada, where she did her PhD. Is this right?
That's right.
And she has published on Canadian literary studies, trans literature and visual art, feminist theory and effect studies. She is the author of a very interesting book I had the chance to take a look at. And the title of this book is Trans-Canadian Feminist Fictions, New Cross-Border Ethics, which was published in 2017, the McGill and Queen's University Press. In 2018, she co-edited a special issue on effect and feminist literary production for Atlantis, which is a journal and critical studies in gender, culture, and social justice. And her latest article, just appeared in the University of Toronto Quarterly, entitled Feeling Sideways, Shani Mutu and Kai Cheng Tom's Sustainable Effects. And today you are talking to us about paradoxical worldlings, reflections on feminist and trans cultures today. Liva, just go ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Doris. Thank you much for the kind introduction. I have very good memories of my time in Innsbruck. So thank you for referring to that as well. I also want to the Center for Interdisciplinary Gender Studies at Innsbruck for inviting me to speak today. I'm very grateful to the center's coordinator, Julia, for helping with all the technical arrangements, and also to Ulla, who we can see here in the Department of English, for agreeing to act as a respondent after the talk. I would also like to thank the audience, of course, because I'm aware of how digitally saturated our world has become. So I really appreciate you joining today, and I look forward to the discussion. So I'll try to keep the lecture to around 30 minutes. All right, so let me open with an epigraph. 2019 and all's well. It is 2020 and all is definitely not well. The ironic words of Larissa Lai's racialized automaton, Rachel, could not be more timely to fathom this age of turbulence. A worldwide pandemic hit the world on March 11th, dramatically affecting the lives of millions of peoples and intensifying structural inequalities at social and political levels. In the words of disability studies scholar Danielle Pierce, quote, if this pandemic has clarified anything, that eugenics is not in the past. Ableist triaging of medical supports, coerced DNRs, herd immunity strategies, and the immense precarity we have institutionalized. So Pierce aptly contends that systemic ableism cannot be separated from ongoing colonialisms. So the livability of minoritized peoples at this particular juncture is at stake. Significantly, though, the death throes of neoliberalism, white backlash, and government by troll, and I love this expression by Larissa Lai, coexists with the unpredictable force of collective protests and injustice movements such as Black Lives Matter, Black Trans Lives Matter, and others. So this paradoxical sense of despair and possibility, polarization and alliance, becomes a methodological tool in the work of the writers and the theorists that I discuss in the first part of this lecture. The remarkable collaborative work and mentorship programs that are emerging between feminist and trans writers of color in Canada, particularly through the relentless work of book publishers such as Arsenal Publishing, will be the focus of the last part of the lecture. So let me start with this subsection that I've paradox as counter methodology. And I'm still thinking through this prefix, so I look forward to any feedback that you may have afterwards. In Notes from a Feminist Killjoy, Essays on Everyday Life, Canadian literary scholar Erin Wunker urges readers to think about paradox as a form of knowledge, an epistemology situated, embodied, and relational. And Wunker explains how she learned this from poetry. And I have to say that I learned this from theory. The feminist and queer worlds of Adrienne Rich, Gloria Anzaldúa, bell hooks, and Audre Lorde taught me how paradox could be disassociated from signaling somehow a failed analytical method and become instead a tool for action and transformation. The complex image of the theories that I just mentioned, with their wonderful gaps, the contradictions, the juxtapositions, enable alternative ways of seeing the world beyond pernicious essentials and binary logics. So I want to pay homage to this genealogy and want to consider paradox as a counter methodology that assembles both the necropolitical and the emergent insurgencies of the world. And I want us to stay with this expression from Larissa Lai's work that appeared in the book Exploring the Fantastic. The essay is called Insurgent Utopias. Writing within the texture of liberal democracies, political theorist Achille Mbembe contends, quote, that the contemporary era is undeniably one of separation, hate movements, hostility, and above all, struggle against an enemy. The society of enmity that Mbembe elucidates not only describes socio-political, but also cultural context. And I think this is crucial for this presentation. The desire for an enemy, Mbembe contends, invariably has one or several objects as its fixation point. I would argue that both the feminist and the trans subject has indeed been turned into such an object of fixation, not only in alt-right discourses, but also in so-called feminist platforms that disseminate deeply transphobic and thus anti-feminist messages. These ongoing cultural wars simultaneously demonize and fetishize trans subjects and communities, paradoxically granting them a form of hypervisibility while disavowing their very right to existence. As scholars Reina Gosset, Eric Stanley, and Johanna Burton aptly contend, quote, in a time of trans visibility, and yet we're also living in a time of anti-trans violence. So I really want to stay with these words today. These paradoxical worldings, as I call them, serve as a counter methodology from which to approach the writer and the artist that I examine in my research, together with the minoritized communities represented in their work. And today I want to discuss Kai-Cheng Thom's latest work, the cross-genre collection, I Hope We Choose Love, A Trans Girl's Notes from the End of the World. Of Chinese ancestry, Thom is a writer, performer, culture, and speaker based in Toronto. She's the author of the novel Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars, A Dangerous Trans Girl's Confabulous Memoir, the poetry collection plays called No Homeland, and the children's picture book From the Stars in the Sky to the Fish in the Sea. And I really want to recommend these books, especially for you who are teaching. I would really recommend Thom's children's picture book if you're interested in questions of gender identity and difference. Thom is also a regular contributor to the digital magazines Everyday Feminism and Extra. And I want to really invite you to check the column that she has, Ask Kai, Advice for the Apocalypse. I think she really has so many answers. So as I talk, when you read Kai-Cheng Thom, you know you're entering a space of paradoxical worldings where violence, trauma, and death coexists with forms of radical joy, love, and pleasure. And I here use the term worlding following Edward Said, Paul Preciado, and Sarah Ahmed, whose trans and feminist theories are world-making, and of course you'll recognize Sarah Ahmed's voice there, and thus pose a threat to those forces that seek to dismantle collective action. So Mbembe refers to the forces of separation and scission that characterize the political and cultural space as delinking, and I want us to take a look at this term. And in turn, Thom proposes reworlding through paradox to challenge these delinking forces and transform the society of enmity into one of accountability, to counter indifference with response, as I've argued elsewhere. So it is with this ethical impulse in mind that I now turn to Thom's collection of essays and poems, which engages with the fractures and alliances of the communities forming, and I quote, the social justice left of North America, Turtle Island. Firmly in 2019, readers are told in the back cover of the book, that the book offers a quote, a call for nuance in a time of political polarization, for healing in a time of justice, and for love in an apocalypse. This paradoxical framework, both temporal and spatial, also permeates the artwork in the front cover, where the word love is capitalized and centered in the page, resting on a blooming red flower and in contrast black color in the background. The suggestive cover designed by Oliver McPartlin, with its multiple juxtapositions and contrasts, entices readers to enter a narrative space where love, violence, care, and death become entangled assemblages. The collection is then divided into three: Let Us Live, Let Us Love, Let Us Believe, written in capital letters, thus signaling the urgency of this plea. At the same time, these emphasize how the ontological question of being, the affective dimension of feeling, and the epistemological question of knowledge are at the heart of Tom's transcripts. I'm gonna talk a little bit about the notion of transpoetics now. This formulation can be traced back to the critical work of Joy Ladin, Trish Salah, Lucas Crawford, and many other queer and trans poets. In Transpoetics Manifesto, which was part of the anthology Troubling the Line, Trans and Gender Queer Poetry and Poetics, Ladin places complexity and contradiction at the center of transpoetics. From its perspective, Ladin explains, transpoetics refers to techniques that enable poetic language to embody or enact some aspect of trans experience. Then from a critic's perspective, they refer to formal categories that bring different poems into meaningful relation. From a reader's perspective, transpoetics means language that makes us realize that we are Toto and there is no Kansas anymore. I think you recognize the reference there. So I find Ladin's words crucial to my argument on Tom's paradoxical poetics, particularly because these complex and contradictory relations that they mention impregnate collective spaces and communities that struggle against racist legacies and ongoing colonial oppression. As Tom puts it in one of the poems in I Hope We Choose Love, quote, how can I feel homesick if I've never been home? The central paradox in these two unpunctuated lines encapsulates the ruptures and longings of the trans diasporic subject, which are tropes recurrent in Tom's poetics. In the last stanza of the poem Diaspora Babies, processes of colonization and displacement intersect, momentarily dissolving subjectivity. And I read from the poem. Diaspora haunted, we hunt for pregnant pauses, give birth from unwanted yellow bodies, like invisible ink poems, ghost children drawing maps in the margins of a place called No Homeland. The lines indicate how diaspora babies are born through interruptions, gaps, and delays, and consequently they grow to the side of official scripts of history. Their collective position, nonetheless, so I would take a look at the we here, opens the door to the possibility of forging cartographies of worlds yet to become. The contradictory imagery in the stanza leaves the reader reflect on the lust and impossibility of meaning, knowing, and being, to borrow words. I would then argue that the philosophical underpinnings in Tom's paradoxical poems further assemble an ethical trans or poetics. In the collection of essays, The Wager, poet and critic Joan Retallack proposes a poetical attitude as a response to swerves that are unpredictable forms of change in the world. Writing within the textures of 9/11, Retallack is invested in a philosophical poetics of responsibility and desire that embraces contradiction, paradox, and the unexpected. Retallack began conceptualizing the term poetics in the late 1980s, so this is a formulation that is grounded in what she calls the historical contemporary, a vital poetics of reciprocal alterity, quote, pregnant with street noises, silences, in strains, stains, contagions, the thickened plots of communitarian ethics, end quote. Retallack's poetics, which I learned from Erin Wunker, and you have the reference there in case you want to read her article, resonate with Tom's paradoxical worldings, where collectives of trans girls and women of color for the right to exist, feel, and thrive under racist and transphobic law. To navigate and not drown in these lethal assemblages, Tom advocates for what she calls accountable love. As seen in the poem Boundaries 1 in the section Let Us Love, the right for pleasure is integral to Tom's poetics. And I read from the poem. Boundaries, they are the space between me, the borderland where fear ends and desire begins. They are the place where love can live without being lost. These unpunctuated lines immerse readers in an open-ending world where relationality is always already part of the self, collective selves that are being made and remade through the mediation of desire, sustaining the possibility of intimacy, the intimacy of bodies assembled in borderland spaces. The parallels and junctions in the poem create a moment of non-location location, and this is Carrie Edwards' phrase, non-location location, that is embodied, relational, and paradoxical, an instance of what I call Tom's necropoetics of love at the end of the world. So I'm very interested in critical interventions in political theory and queer and trans studies. And I draw on some of these to formulate the term necropoetics and how it signals how techniques of death often infuse the poetics of trans literary and artistic worlds. These necropoetics confront readers with several ethical conundrums about who counts as a human being, whose life is disposable, and whose life is indispensable. And thus it urges others for action to reconstitute justice. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the theory that I'm drawing from. In the essay Necropolitics, French Style, 2013, trans studies scholar Paul Preciado condemns the French national Christian rhetoric as a language of hatred that promotes, quote, the militarization of social and the transformation of public space into surveillance space, end quote. I would argue that Preciado's premonitory words resonate in contexts such as the US with its necropolitical government, or in Canada with the systemic violation of indigenous rights. And we're seeing that every day now, unfortunately, with all the violence against the Mi'kmaq peoples in Nova Scotia, for example. And of course, we're also seeing it in different places. So as Preciado blatantly puts it, techniques of death include closing the borders, armoring uteruses, expelling immigrants, locking up or exterminating racialized bodies, homosexuals, transsexuals, end quote. Thus, the notion of the necropolitical has a direct relation to queer and trans racialized bodies and communities who are systematically relegated outside the script of the human, as queer theorist Jasper Poor very well taught us. And I want to mention other scholars who've done a lot of work on queer and trans necropolitics. So scholars such as Jean Harita Warren, Adi Kunzman, and Sylvia Posako further claim, quote, that trans necropolitics include everyday death worlds, such as systemic transmisogyny, racist affect, and of course, this is a term that I'm using from Membe as well. Other mundane regimes of abandonment, stability, and subtler forms of debilitation. And you can also hear poor here as well. So the ordinariness of death worlds sat Tom's necropoetic narrative textures while necessarily begging a call for the right to existence. Worlds being born and coming alive is indeed a constant in Tom's transpoetics, as we saw earlier, worldings that entail an ethical reorganization of experience. Talking about ethics, in the introduction to Necropolitics, Membe asks readers an question. How can one recognize in the enemy's face that one seeks to blow away, but whose wounds one could equally treat, another that renders them in their full humanity, and thus as similar to oneself? In Levinasian fashion, Membe urges us to grant others who are different from us the humanity that we demand for ourselves. This requires envisioning other types of relationality and kinship based on links instead of following the brutal demand of imposed isolation and stillness common to societies of enmity. And I want to say that I find echoes of Membe's words in Thom's essays, where she proposes ethical love as an antidote for survival in this particular context. Quote from Tom. I mean love that is kind, but also honest. Love that is courageous and relentless and willing to break the rules and smash the love that cares about people more than ideas, but prizes each and every one of us as essential and indispensable. I mean love that is compassionate and accountable. So this is an ethical and a politicized love that is very difficult to enact when anger ensures some of the community's survival. And this is something that Audre Lorde, for example, has taught us well. Tom's words further echo Membe's in that both propose a return to a sense of shared humanity and recognition of the other at a time that is often represented as apocalyptic. I would argue that this challenges liberal conceptualization of the individual to propose instead collectives where interdependence is a prerequisite for existence. So this accountable love with its impossibility and its potential demands for the formation of unexpected alliances and, to follow Retallack's words, border transgressive commitments. In Canada, for example, feminist and trans-identified artists and writers are opening the door to extraordinary actions and radical forms of care as active forces of change towards the goal of social justice. So it is in this vein that I now turn to briefly look at the collaborative work between artist and writer Vivek Sraya and the independent publishing house Arsenal Pulp Press. For those of you who are not familiar with her work, Soraya's cross-border archive includes an impressive range of audiovisual work, the poetry collection Even This Page Is White, queer young adult children with titles such as God Loves Hair and The Boy and the Bindi, the best-selling book I'm Afraid of Men, and the recent comic book Death Threat, illustrated by the acclaimed artist Lee. I also wanted to mention a different book because now they're doing the 10th year anniversary edition there. And I want to really recommend it and especially mention it in terms of the collaboration that Soraya has with Juliana Neufeld and how Soraya describes this collaboration as one of reciprocity and nourishment. So as you can see rather explicitly from some of her titles, Soraya's oeuvre offers numerous examples of necropoetics at work. death worlds of homophobia, racism, and transphobia intimately coexist with poetic acts of resistance and creativity. And I don't have time now to go into some of her work in such detail as I did with Tom, but I was actually more interested now in commenting a little bit on the kind of collaborations that she's done with Pulp Press as a way to also respond to all this everyday death worlds through reciprocal alliances in this feminist, queer, and trans writers. So I want to mention this. So in December 2017, Soraya and Arsenal Pulp announced writer and book for the new VS Books imprint, which is a mentorship and publishing opportunity for an Indigenous or Black writer or writer of color living in Canada. So initially, the call targeted writers between the ages of 18 and 24. Then the following year, they expanded it to 28. And interestingly enough, the current call has introduced a significant change. So now they seek to attract people over 50 years old, which is remarkable in terms of expanding the notion of emerging writer and forging intergenerational alliances. So this opportunity, the mentorship program, includes editorial feedback, a publishing contract, a marketing plan, and general support, which I think is absolutely amazing considering, the sometimes limited opportunities that some writers have. And I want to mention the result of the first collaboration, which was Thea Mutonji's debut collection of short stories, Shut Up Your, which was published in 2019. I want to say that Mutonji was born in Congo, Kinshasa, and raised in Scarborough, Ontario, and that her work was chosen according to one of Soraya's interview, because it was unpredictable. So I'm very interested in this idea of the unexpected. Writer supported by this initiative has been Cicely Bell Blaine, a UK-born activist and writer who identifies as a queer non-binary femme. They are the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Vancouver. Their just published poetry collection, Burning Sugar, is informed by their lived experience, quote, as an intersectional feminist liberation activist. And I really look forward to reading it. So I want to say that this mentorship and publishing initiative stands as an example of, I would say, an excellent example of how feminist and trans worldings can align to offer, in Soraya's words, nurturing and reciprocal collaborations. And I really want to invite you to hear the recent podcast that was published by, what's the name of the publisher? Book Publishers in Edmonton by our dear friend Jason. So I really recommend you to take a listen. So now to close, I've been repeating this actually for some years now, but I want to say it again in this final remarks. These are paradoxical times for feminism. We live in a moment of puzzling unpredictability. Neo-fascisms, transphobia, hatred against women, and ultra-nationalist forces proliferate in tandem with unprecedented creative possibility and social mobilization, all attesting to the vitalism of anti-capitalism, racist, feminist, queer, and trans mobilization. We're simultaneously witnessing intense fractures between different feminist and trans-identified groups, a division that greatly damages the possibility to continue building worlds to fight oppressive structures at this current time of growing feminist backlash and anti-trans violence. It's more important than ever, perhaps, to celebrate anti-racist work, feminist work, trans work, that imagine is more ethical worlds in the search for social justice. So as I've hoped to show today, writers and artists such as Kai Cheng Thom and Vivek Soraya are also responding to the necropolitical by advocating for revolutionary modes and love between feminist and trans communities through their paradoxical poetics. So to close now, let me circle back to the beginning. Me and all is not well. This is why it is vital to envision what the unexpected may bring and be attentive to the emergent insurgencies of the world, Larissa Lai again, together with the critical and aesthetic labor of the literary imagination to counter racist structures and forge more ethical futures. After all, to borrow the words of Nova Scotian filmmaker and multimedia artist Sylvia D. Hamilton, quote, "We will always have music and poetry." Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Liva. I'm sorry it took some time to get back to the screen. Thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. And I think there will be a lot of questions and also comments to this to this approach, which also somehow sounds familiar to me. I mean, many concepts. Well, but we talk about this later. So, as you all know, the gender lectures always follow a very particular protocol, so to speak. And it's now Ulla's turn. Ulla, would you please? Okay. So there's always a lecture and then somebody who comments the lecture. And for today's lecture, it's Ulla who assures the commentary. And I would just like to briefly introduce Ulla Rathheiser to you. She teaches English, literature and cultural studies at the University of Innsbruck. And her research focuses on post-colonial studies, contemporary migrant writing, and more recently, the use of literature in second language acquisition. One central aspect of her work are gender representations and female spaces in cultural texts. And her latest article has just come out entitled "Toxic Masculinity and Acid Humor." Thank you, Ulla, for doing this response. Please, just go ahead.
I almost forgot to turn on my microphone. Okay. thank you ever so much, Liebe, for taking us into a territory also of hope in times of increasing division. A territory that manages to productively employ the paradoxes of our world to literally push the boundaries. Bear with me for not adding to the scholarly insights that Liebe has so beautifully delineated. I will try to share my very personal reaction and my reading of what Liebe has just suggested. Obviously, there are several dimensions to your talk, Liebe, that have struck a chord with me. There are four aspects in particular that resonated. For once, it was the notion of conceiving of the paradox as a methodological tool rather than an aberration, a testimony to the fact that our lives effectively operate outside the dichotomies we have gotten so used to that we perceive them as normal. In addition to this, what came out so clearly in your talk is, and this is, of course, especially important to me as a literary studies person, is the relevance of literature when it comes to our worldings also, whatever they may be in our specific situations. The powerful examples you have quoted from and or mentioned testify to this ability to intervene in and build worlds. Another dimension that struck me was how these worldings, trans and feminist, fundamentally rely on embodiment and how this becomes part of a trans poetics. Eventually, what caught my attention is once more the intersectionality of these issues at stake here, the various forms of suppression and attempted obliteration that take shape along crisscrossing lines of gender, race, ability, etc., that make it all the more important to resist attempts to divide. So I've just tried and list some of these dimensions that really seemed important to me. I would now like to briefly discuss each individually a bit more. The first aspect, the paradox as a methodological tool, I find particularly intriguing in that it constitutes a contradiction to the hegemony of mainstream or mass cultural representations and ideas. It comes to challenge the apparent norms and processes of normalization, I find. It introduces, as Lieber has just pointed out, and I quote from your lecture, Lieber, alternative ways of seeing the world beyond pernicious essentialisms and binary logic. Of course, our world cannot healthily be divided along a binary logic, even though we are made to believe this and are trained to readily buy into this notion of society in neat, little, strictly demarcated boxes, be it in terms of gender identity or also ethnicity, to just name a few. Fortunately, our world is much messier, I would say, much less clear-cut and much more fascinating for it. And employing paradox framings, as you've just shown, can allow us to explore this productively. In this, also the seeming paradox of living in a time of heightened transvisibility, but also increasing transviolence, becomes unfortunately explicable through the society of enmity, as you've just pointed out, in reference to Mbembe's theories. In that trans communities maneuver beyond the essentialism of our society, a sense of threat seems to be triggered in people who position themselves firmly within a normative society. Their desire for an enemy, to once more take up Mbembe's dictum, finds a target in the increasingly visible challenge to their essentialist notions, such as in trans and queer identities. Literary strategies to explore and dismantle the dichotomies inherent in these normative social structures, interestingly enough, also rely on the paradox, as Lieber has just shown. Thus, boundaries are literally presented as unstable, shifting, fluid, as in the beautiful example of Kai Cheng Thom's poems, Boundaries 1. Here the reader is invited, as Lieber has demonstrated, to explore the borderland with the lyrical eye, a space that is not defined by the exclusion it normally denotes, but by the possibility to meet uninhibited by social restrictions. The poem very much reminded me of Carolyn Duffy's Words, White Night. The verse is written by the first female Scottish and openly LGBTQ poet laureate in Britain, find a similar tone in musing over the relation between desire and distance and what created in between by means of words. If boundaries, however, can also be moved, as in Thom's poem, it seems possible in a wider context to envisage relations that are not based on contrasts and enmity, relations that transcend the ideas of the neatly demarcated boxes of our world and allow for community, as Lieber calls it, based on shared worldings, or also compassionate love, to take us back to Thom. Eventually, we cannot imagine these worldings, as Lieber has established them, disengaged from the physical body. And this is another dimension that has really struck a chord with me. As Kai Cheng Thom writes on her website, I have to admit, I had to Google her. She writes, "I want to find the place where your fear ends and my body begins. Ultimately, it is the body where the sense of being is situated, where the agency can be assumed and a paradox acknowledged. Thus, it seems only natural that a trans poetics will particularly seek to situate the body in the language employed. That the body can indeed take all imaginable shapes is, of course, part of the agenda here. Very importantly, Lieber has illustrated also the intersectionality at work when it comes to questions of gender, inviting, in my view, also a shared agency. After all, to take up a phrase from Kai Cheng Thom, not only should there be room for all at the feminist table, and of course, I borrowed this phrase from Lieber, but indeed there is. A transphobic message is indeed an anti-feminist message. I agree with what you've said earlier, Lieber. And it is high time that the notion of divide et impera, divide and rule, is refuted alongside other necropolitical impulses in insurgencies of all kinds, literary and cultural productions, and alliances of feminist and trans worldings.
Thank you, Ulla, for this wonderful comment, response to Lieber's paper. So what we...
Just quickly thank Ulla and just say a couple of quick things.
Okay.
Thank you so much for that very generous and very a reading of the talk. And I just want to say that I love this idea of someone giving a talk and then someone responding, because it maybe it's again another exercise in interpretive work, right? So it's just super interesting to deliver some remarks and then having someone kind of like relive them and experience them critically. And you've so many important points here that I want to go back to when I continue working on the paper. So I don't want to take more space, but
yeah. Thank you. Well, what we normally do now, and what you just said, Lieber, was, by the way, the initial idea of this paper response format. So, yeah. Okay. We now normally give the word to the audience, and as Julia Tuckner already wrote into the chat, you can now ask your questions via the chat box. So we just while we wait for a question from the audience, may I ask a question? Or may I personally comment? Because I'm, of course, socialized, intellectually socialized in France. When I listened to all the things you said about the paradox and also about care, and well, I associate many things that you've said to the principle of care, and I couldn't but think of somebody who is maybe today kind of outdated, but who was very important to me in dealing with paradoxes and with the intersectional space. And this was Jacques Derrida as a philosopher with his concept of difference, difference with an R, which is defining a space where paradoxes are allowed, where nothing ever comes to where binary concepts are diluted. And so I was quite surprised because this immediately came to my mind, you know, as he was maybe one of the first philosophers who digged theoretically into this possibility of keeping alive this constant, this, I don't know how to call it, this in between, you know, where binary the concepts, binary concepts are diluted or not allowed to materialize. This was just a comment too. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought of relating this to Derrida, your positions, or?
Thank you so much for the comment. I'll definitely think about it. I think my philosophical trajectory has maybe taken me other places. I come more from a Spinozist tradition, mm-hmm. via different philosophers. So I think that's kind of like the trajectory that I've followed in terms of thinking about questions of difference, but also in terms of how different emotions and feelings can actually encourage us to act. Mm-hmm. and how that can help us also reconsider questions of borders and boundaries. But it definitely can also try and go back to Derrida. I read him in my undergrad, actually. So it's been like 20 years. So I should go back, maybe.
Okay. So did you get a chance to read the response or the question of Emilia Quinn? Thanks so much for your talk, Liebe. I was just wondering about the relationship between what you're calling necropoetics and Judith Butler's work on the powers of mourning for advancing a sense of community and resistance. With her sense of mourning, as the shock of recognition of our interconnection with others. Does the question of mourning come into your necropoetical research?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. It hasn't come into it yet, but I think that's a very interesting reference. And of course, I can think of all of Butler's work on questions of vulnerability, precarity, precarious bodies, disposable bodies, which in a way resonates very much with, for instance, Kai Cheng Thom's systematic trying to dismantle this, what she calls this culture of disposability, where we live in, where the bodies of different populations are rendered disposable by different hegemonic systems of power. So I can definitely see a lot of connections with Butler's theoretical framework. I haven't really touched on the question of vulnerability, for example, because I don't know how to put this, maybe, but I've never felt that comfortable with using the word vulnerability critically, and I need to think a bit more carefully, maybe, about why this is. Because there's so much very interesting feminist and trans work coming out of this almost field of vulnerability studies in connection to Butler. But I think in my understanding of necropoetics, I think I'm more interested in how we can find ways to respond to techniques of death, death worlds, you know, all the different terms that we're discussing here, how we can respond ethically, maybe collectively, to some of these necropolitical impulses, and literature and not necessarily just poetry can actually help us find this way of a world, which I guess goes back to Ulla's comment about literature that helps us build and create worlds, which can actually be almost like therapeutic in terms of like counteracting feelings of loss and trauma, for example. And I have to say that Kat Chiam, she's a therapist by training. So she's written extensively about trauma in many of her essays, and I really recommend work in that sense as well. If Emilia, if you're interested in questions of loss, mourning, and so on. But this is an important question. Thank you.
May I ask another question, Liebe? You used the expression or the concept, or you presented it very shortly, the concept of collective selves, you know, and I was quite intrigued by this idea. What might a collective self be, actually? Could you please dig a little deeper into this?
Thank you for the question. I guess if I position myself within feminist, or if I position myself as a feminist teacher and maybe a feminist critic, I have to say that I'm always very suspicious of the how the use of the first person singular, especially the capitalized I, has functioned in different humanist discourses. So I think there's a lot of interesting work being done through post-humanist ethics, for example, via the work of Rosie Brighton and others, who are trying to problematize this sense of the idea of the bounded individual of the Renaissance, so to speak, and try to problematize it with all its, you know, ingrained sexism, racism, ableism that this normative citizen embodies. So I'm always very interested in trying to find ways to move away from this I and try to find collective worlds, collective ways of proceeding. And this can be done in different ways through the way we understand our teaching, you know, how we interact with our students, through the way we understand our research and how we engage with collaborative work, which I think is, in a way, the antidote for something some of us have in this world of academia. So it depends on how you understand this idea of collectivity. So for me, yeah, I go back to teaching, I go back to research, I go back to collaboration, and I go back to those writers, especially this feminist and in Canada, who are just absolutely amazing work. It's just like helping opening this world where suddenly you have, as I said, like an alternative ways of seeing and feeling and acting in the world. And I think that gives us a lot of maybe inspiration through the imagination to create some of these collective futures, perhaps.
Okay, thank you. There's another question. Milena Leibold, she asks, could you imagine linking Tom's and others' work to the notion or concept of poetic speech acts as form of resistance? And she quotes Davidson.
Well, that's super interesting. Thank you for that question. I haven't read Davidson, actually, so but I want to say that thinking of Butler's work, for instance, and how discourse is created and formed, I see a lot of potential in trying to connect you know, my understanding of Tom's poetics with the question of how body verses are produced and reproduced performatively speaking. So thank you for that.
Are there any more questions or comments? Okay, so what can I say, Liebe? This was an extremely interesting talk about so many authors I've never come across, because I only stick to the Francophone part of Canada. And I'm very happy that you introduced us to these very interesting texts. I'm so keen to dig into a little deeper. It's just amazing. I didn't know most of the writers.
Thank you. And I have to say that the writers obviously speak for themselves, so you don't need me at all there to really go back and check their amazing work.
You've chosen so wonderful passages. They're just breathtaking. Is there another? Milena has another comment for you, I guess, in the chat.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so Thank you all for having been here with us and for having listened to Liebe's talk. I would just announce the next gender lecture on the 26th of January. This next gender lecture will take us into a very different field, into the field of law. Michel Cottier from the University of Geneva will talk about parenthood in parenthood beyond heterosexuality, and this sounds really interesting. The German title is Elternschaft im Recht jenseits von Heterosexualität und Zweigeschlechtlichkeit als Norm. So this gender lecture will take place on the 26th of January at 7 p.m. And Caroline Voithofer from the Department of Common Law, Institut für Zivilrecht, will moderate the gender lecture. And Michael Ganner, ebenfalls vom Institut für Zivilrecht, will do the response. Thank you and have a nice evening. Thank you, Liebe.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a lovely evening.